What a finish from Balogun.
Oh, Ben Yedda, beautifully done.
Bobby Young, surely. There it is.
Mbappe now. Wonderful.
Gotta be. Lovely finish.
Go for goal. Darren Mbappe.
It's Elie Wahi. Well, it's been coming.
Put in by Jonathan Davies. Kylian Mbappe brings the Parc des Princes to its feet.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Le Beau Jeu, the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast in English. We are back again for another round of Le Beau Jeu. And at Marseille, it's all changed. Jean-Louis Gasset has the Olympians firing. 4-1 winners over Montpellier, 5-1 hammerers of Clermont, and they're into the Europa League last 16 as well. So Marseille's disastrous season may yet have a silver lining. The talk of the town is still Kylian Mbappe. Only today, we brought in a transfer expert in Ben Jacobs to give us the lowdown on Kylian's move to, by all accounts, still not official, Real Madrid. Our professor this afternoon is not Andreas Evagora. It's Angus Terode, who's going to give us a very special profile of Stade de Reims. Schema Teddy Turma. And that's good because we've got a Teddy Turma jersey to give away this month as part of our Deja Vu quiz as well. We're going to have all the action from Ligue 1 Uber Eats over the last 2 weeks. We're going to give you the results and look ahead in the Coupe de France as well as European reviews and previews. To do all of that and more, myself, Robbie Thompson, I am pleased to say I'm joined by CBS Viacom's man in Paris, Jonathan Johnson. You are in Paris, JJ, at least for the time being.
I am in Paris, heading off to the Basque country tomorrow on Tuesday, but we are recording on a Monday, so I am still in Paris for the moment.
Fantastic. And then we have Le Classique podcast impresario, Baptiste Reynaud. Good morning, Baptiste. How are you going?
I'm great. Thanks, Robbie. My place in London, but my heart is in Laval today.
Fantastic. Like the other people that live out in Laval as well, I'm sure. A very proud corner of the world. What's it best known for, Baptiste, Laval?
God.
Anything?
Being spelt the same way, the other way around.
Forwards and backwards.
And Mayenne having more cows than people, I think, is probably the two claims to fame for Stade Lavalois. But a proud history nonetheless.
Fantastic. Well, don't forget you are listening to Le Beau Jeu, the official Ligue 1 podcast in English. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms, so don't forget to give us a rating, 5 stars preferably, and a little review, and spread the word. Okay, as always, gentlemen, we're going to start with a review of rounds 23 and 24. JJ, we know you're a Parisian through and through. Let's talk about Marseille. First of all, we've got to talk a little bit about Jean-Louis Gasset because this is an incredible story. I mean, what was he even doing at the head of the Côte d'Ivoire, really? I mean, that already is an astounding appointment. He gets sacked from that. They bring him into Marseille. If there was an anti-Longoria signing or type of character personality, it was old school Jean-Louis Gasset and his even older school assistant, Ghislain Printemps. And here they are, these two old men. They've almost got their Zimmer frames out when they walk, you know, along the sideline at the Stade Velodrome, and they're doing it. It's incredible.
It is, but also at the same time, I think anyone who knows Jean-Louis Gasset knows that he is a very old school football man, you know, somebody who really commands the respect of a number of his players. I'm sure you remember from his time at PSG, Robbie. You know, it's very difficult to command the respect of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, but it's something that, you know, Gasset was able to do as the longtime assistant of Laurent Blanc. But then obviously struck out on his own sort of in the last few postings that he's had in French football, Saint-Etienne, Bordeaux, mixed, you know, experiences there, obviously, and then ended up, as you say, as the head coach of Ivory Coast. I mean, if you look at sort of what he's walked away from that situation with, a winner's medal. I know he got sacked after the group stage of AFCON, but he still got a winner's medal for those games in the group stage. You know, he's now suddenly turning things around at OM, and it's actually looking pretty rosy for him. But I think it is important to flag up that as sort of WTF as the as this situation is from sort of all angles to see, you know, Gasse turning up at Stade Velodrome. It's important to note that there have been changes made behind the scenes recently. The addition of Mehdi Benatia to the hierarchy there sounds like that played an important part in the decision to bring him in, also to separate with Gattuso. Because let's be honest, you know, as much as Gattuso is a very passionate, very fiery individual, which does sort of in theory match well with the Marseille fan base, it was disastrous tactically. Some of the performances that they put in, the results that they suffered, you know, they were going nowhere fast. They certainly looked like they were dropping out of all contention for Europe. And suddenly, you know, with Gasse taking things back to basics, you know, not sidelining players who, you know, are sort of undisputable starters, you know, things have started to look up and they're scoring goals. They're feeling the confidence. Tricky tie in the Europa League coming up, a quirky twist of fate season. Reunite with Marcelino there, but it's been amazing. A good couple of weeks, yeah, for OM in terms of sort of the change made and the immediate impact that Gasse has had. And as much as he was a failure with the Ivory Coast at AFCON on home soil, I would say it doesn't surprise me too much to see that he's thriving in a situation where he's had to just take things back to basics.
Baptiste, one thing we noticed in the match against Clermont and Montpellier was just the players are like, they've had a weight lifted off their shoulders. I mean, I don't know whether that's an overbearing Gattuso or a presence or something that had everyone scared. It always reminds me, Jean-Louis Gasse, because he was Laurent Blanc's assistant at Bordeaux. And I remember the Suleiman Diawara story, which is just the most sensational story. They had this player that they'd brought to Bordeaux, and he just wasn't playing well. He couldn't settle and everything. And Jean-Louis Gasse would go and talk to him and say, "What's going on?" He says, "I don't know, coach. I mean, I'm doing everything right. I've stopped going out. I'm off the drink. I don't do anything. I just..." And Jean-Louis Gasse just said, "Tomorrow night's Thursday. That's student night in Bordeaux. You're going out. You're getting slaughtered. You do whatever you want and then come back." And so he comes back on Friday morning, a bit dusty to training, plays the next day, man of the match performance from Suleiman Diawara, goes on to win the league, wins the league the next year at Marseille, wins, I think, 3 Coupe de la Ligues in a row. I mean, it's a classic Jean-Louis Gasse story. You know, I can understand how he's got Jonathan Clauss scoring a fantastic goal like that. It just speaks of that freedom that he brings and his... an ability. I mean, he's 70 or 71. We talk these days about how coaches have to be able to relate to the younger generation and all this sort of thing. He's the archetypal opposite, and perhaps it's that. It works. He does. He relates to these young players, and he's like their grandpa or something, and he manages to get the best out of them.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, if we have to take it back as well, he's widely respected, I think, in the French football world. He was one of the best assistants for about 15, 20 years. And I think the common denominator with the teams he was helping manage was that they played attacking, free-flowing football that put those players in the best conditions possible to freely express themselves. So if you look at Bordeaux, a lot of those players, the Suleiman Diawaras, but also the likes of Mathieu Chalmé, Kavenaghi, Chamakh, they had their best years by being allowed to play to their strength. And when he was supporting Laurent Blanc at PSG, I think this is some of the best ball-playing PSG sides we've seen over the last decade, right? So it doesn't so much surprise me that he's come in and has brought a bit of sort of serenity, sense of humor, and has just told his players to just go out there and enjoy themselves. I'm actually quite happy for him because I think his most recent experience wasn't a positive one, but I think there was a little bit of mockery because of his age and his experience with Ivory Coast. But actually, over the last 15 years, he's been one of the most influential assistants, certainly in French football. And his time at Saint-Étienne was actually quite successful, considering everything that happened afterwards. And at Bordeaux, no one was going to be able to steady that ship. So, you know, even his experiences as number one were broadly positive. And I think it's just a reward for somebody who's been dedicated to his craft for a long time and has found a way to adapt. So it's the slight caution I would utter is just Montpellier and Clermont are not exactly powerhouses of French football in a positive dynamic right now. So, great to see Marseille free flowing and free scoring, but they'll have tougher opponents ahead.
JJ, how far can he take this Marseille side? I mean, Marseille, for all their trials and tribulations this season, they sit seventh, but they're only sort of 5 points off Europe. Lille are fourth on 41, Marseille seventh on 36. Can they turn it around and can they enjoy? I mean, Marseille have always, compared to other French clubs, and obviously there's the big one in 1993 in the Champions League, but even since then, they've enjoyed these runs in Europe as well. Are we looking at the dawn of something special in these final 2.5 months of the season?
I really hope so. I mean, I think it would be huge, you know, not just for Marseille's season, but for French football in general, you know, to have a strong OM, you know, make a deep run in Europe, especially after that sort of disastrous playoff that we saw a week or so ago, where we were sort of, we had our fingers crossed that we were going to have maybe two, possibly even three teams from Ligue 1, you know, scrape through, and then suddenly you're left relying on Marseille in the final round of the fixtures, the late games, to pull it out of the hat against Shakhtar. So thankfully they did that, you know, and France still has a team in each of the European competitions this season. And I think that has to be the focus now for Guessé and this Marseille side. Stay in the European positions in the league, but don't sort of put too much emphasis on breaking into the Champions League spots, but just give the Europa League everything that they possibly can. Because if you look at this next matchup on paper, with all due respect to Villarreal, they're not quite the same vintage of team that won the tournament a couple of years ago under Unai Emery. I think this is a good chance for OM to reach the quarterfinals. And if we could have sort of two or even three teams getting into the quarterfinals, you know, I think that would be a really big boost for Ligue 1. And once a club like Marseille, with the history, with the heritage, the tradition that it has, gets to that kind of stage of the competition, you can't rule them out going further. You can't rule out a possible trip to the semis, possibly even further. You know, we saw them reach the final a couple of years ago. I think it was the Europa League, where they missed out to Atletico. You know, I think that is sort of the kind of run, you know, that we really have to hope that Marseille can manage to pull out. And given that Guessé probably knows that it's a short-term posting for him at Stade Vélodrome, you know, I think that definitely has to be the objective, to just make the most of the remaining opportunities this season. And that is the biggest of them.
Well, Marseille still have a little way to go before they're seriously knocking on the European qualifying places for next season. Baptiste, let's move on and have a look at the league leaders at the moment, Paris Saint-Germain. They've still got just that one defeat of the season. It came now, very early on in the campaign, against Nice. We'll chat about them in a couple of moments' time. Haven't been able to maintain that cracking pace at the start of the season. Paris Saint-Germain, after a fantastic run, are just not maintaining that pace themselves at the moment either. And I think the biggest talking point at the moment is, where are the goals coming from or not coming from? Kylian Mbappe, we saw him left on the bench 2 weeks ago. Here he's subbed off at halftime. They've drawn 1-1 with Rennes with a last minute penalty at home from Gonçalo Ramos. And some might say that the penalty was a little bit generous, and then they failed to score in a scoreless draw with Monaco. Are they just keeping a sharp focus on European football now, or is this a pretty nervy moment for Paris Saint-Germain to negotiate with Kylian leaving and the striking situation? You know, the big question is, where are the goals going to come from?
Yeah, I think it's a nervy period of the year for PSG. February and March tend to be nervy.
Have proved to be nervy in the past.
and they find a way to make that more nervous than they need it to be, frankly speaking. But I think it's a combination of things. Obviously, the news around Mbappe leaving at the end of the season has come to a head. And that's also meant that for the last year or so, despite investing in Kolo Muani and Gonçalo Ramos, those guys haven't necessarily been given a prolonged run in the side. So to then ask, for example, Ramos to lead the line on his own with service that he's not necessarily used to aside from training, I think is maybe a big ask, although he's obviously talented. So that might explain the slight disconnect up top for PSG. But I think it's, you know, it goes to the dressing room. I think it's a period of a year when basically for PSG, the Ligue 1 doesn't really matter anymore. They're being brought to the club for one thing only, that's the Champions League. And that's when it starts to become squeaky bum time, effectively, for all the players. And when you see one of your leaders, who is and remains the best player at the club, being treated in a particular way and not feeling like he's the most welcome in the dressing room necessarily, that it's going to create a bit of discontent all around and not the most serene atmosphere. And I think that's what we're seeing at the moment.
JJ, what do you make of this current situation at PSG? And I hear what Baptiste is saying. When I was at PSG, I really riled against this notion that everyone is just here, that we were all just there only for one thing, which was the Champions League. Because inside, you think, you see the hard work, you see how hard the club is working on various platforms to try and make this thing a solid club moving forward on all levels. But then it is true that at the end of the day, they have spent an awful lot of money trying to be the side that leads French football forward, that lifts the Champions League trophy, because obviously that's the number one prize for club football in Europe. And they haven't been able to do it. I mean, the 2020 final that they lost against Bayern Munich is as close as they've come. They've changed their policy, and we're going to chat to Ben Jacobs in a moment about their transfer policy and how that's changed. But JJ, how do you see this Paris Saint-Germain side as it stands at the moment? Because one defeat, they're 9 points clear at the top of the table, and yet no one is ever really going to be happy with them, are they?
No, that's true. And I mean, I think that's a hangover as well of sort of the previous approaches to success. And I think it's going to take, you know, many years before that's, you know, completely forgotten or, you know, finally, you know, the success that everyone has craved since the beginning of the Qatari project for it to truly be put to bed. You know, I think it's sort of been there for too many years for PSG to suddenly say, we're not, you know, focusing on Champions League success anymore. You know, and I think the situation at this moment in time, I mean, the thing that I think is most, that grates the most about this kind of situation is it always seems to be timed just sort of when the return to Champions League action comes, and it almost always comes, you know, from within as well. You know, I can sympathize to an extent with Mbappe about the situation and sort of some of the way that it's been handled. But equally, you know, I can completely see and understand Luis Enrique's point of view as well. You know, with Mbappe sort of communicating that he intends to leave at the end of the season, there's no reason that Luis Enrique should continue to build the team around him. You know, he's not going to completely sideline him and leave him out of all of the big Champions League games. But as Baptiste said, given the lead that PSG have at the top of Ligue 1 and the way that they're going well in the Coupe de France at the moment, you know, they can afford to sort of experiment a little bit more domestically now, because guys like Ramos, guys like Kolo Muani, they are the guys who are going to be leading the line for PSG next season when Mbappe leaves. So to that extent, I do understand it. But for me, the thing that is most bizarre in all of this is the timing. Sort of, you know, PSG win the first leg against a difficult Sociedad team, more difficult, I think, mm-hmm. than many of us expected. And then almost sort of overnight, the news filters out, you know, and suddenly that puts the second leg in a completely different complexion. And along with it, the rest of the second half of the season. So now I think that there's suddenly been this buildup of pressure that wasn't actually necessarily there coming into the first leg, but just because of the timing of this news more than anything.
We are going to chat about Paris Saint-Germain's Champions League match away to Real Sociedad in a moment. So we'll leave that part of the discussion there and come back to it, because it is a very interesting talking point around that and what we can expect as well in Europe from Les Rouges et Bleus. Let's have a look at Stade Brestois. We've spoken a lot about the Pirates. Baptiste, they're continuing on their way. I mean, I feel like I say it every time that it's just astonishing to me. I mean, we've just seen Mardi Camara score a hat-trick. Brest are doing everything just right. Brest are continuing on their way. Even when they don't play that well, they still get the result, like on the weekend against Le Havre, where Pierre Lesmelou got the 1-0 win. They're 9 points behind Paris Saint-Germain, but they've picked up 4 points on them in the last 2 weeks. I mean, they're closing the gap, Baptiste.
it's a sensational story, and I think everybody deserves a lot of credit at that club. And what I would like to point out as well is this has been going on for 15 months now. This is not just a half a season mm-hmm. of great success. I mean, Eric Roy took over, I think, in January last year, and since then they've just been picking up points constantly. And I think Grégory Lorenzi, who's the sporting director, deserves a lot of credit for looking at Eric Roy, who was a familiar name to a lot of people, but not necessarily associated with coaching anymore, and would have been seen as a bit of a blast from the past and not necessarily the most ambitious of signings as a manager. So he deserves a lot of credit. I think what you're saying is a side that's really well coached, with players who know their roles, play within them, but also have a little bit of freedom that allows them to go that extra gear, and they just keep on going. I think it's also credit to Brest that during the January transfer window, they didn't let anyone go. There were loads of offers for Brassier and Lys Melou, apparently, and they just said, nope, we're going to keep going, and we'll see at the end of the season what that means for our players. But this season, we're going to keep going and keep being ambitious, and they're reaping the benefits from that. And what's wonderful for me is that there are no real outstanding players that you think, if I could just transfer Pierre-Lys Melou back to Nice or to OM, he would be a star. And even somebody like Lilian Brassier, I think they just are a real collective unit. And it's a joy to watch, frankly. It's just players playing at the top of their game and enjoying it and playing together.
JJ, Monaco. We just heard or saw that they drew scoreless with Paris Saint-Germain. It was a very entertaining match from a Monaco side that are showing that, you know, when things come together, and perhaps after a difficult start to the season, a bit of pressure on Hütter, the Austrian coach, you know, they beat Lens 3-2 2 weeks ago. They're still there or thereabouts. The only thing we know for certain, because Adi Hütter said it, is that Follerin Balogun is not taking penalties anymore because he can't find the back of the net. But apart from that, you know, can this Monaco side yet produce a surprise?
Well, he did score a very nice goal away at Lens a week or so ago, so I don't think we should completely overlook that. But yeah, it's been a pretty rough period for Balogun from the spot and beyond as well. Obviously, you know, he played his part in that Coupe de France exit on penalties to Rouen. But I think, you know, this Monaco side, they definitely have the quality to be in that discussion for the Champions League places and are starting to recover a bit of lost ground. They were playing with, you know, a decent amount of confidence, and I think had Gianluigi Donnarumma not been in as sharp form as he was last Friday, they might have even snuck the win against PSG. But, you know, I think for the remainder of the season now, sort of no distraction in the domestic cup, as I mentioned, you know, I think this Monaco side can now really focus on getting itself into the Champions League reckoning. Obviously, you know, this is part of a new sort of era as well, because, you know, Monaco had the summer overseen by Paul Mitchell shaping the squad for this season, but he's now handed over, you know, basically the keys to the club to Thiago Scuro. So it's going to be a new era in that respect, potentially a new era in a more profound way as well, given the reports that, you know, Monaco's owner, Dmitry Rybolovlev, is fielding offers for the club as well, which creates an interesting dynamic between now and the end of the season in terms of if they reach the Champions League, sort of what that does for potentially investment opportunities. But, you know, Monaco have a tradition, a pedigree to live up to. And the last couple of seasons, they've fallen a bit short of that. And I do think that they have the quality in that team, you know, to manage to get themselves back into Europe, where they belong, in my opinion, as one of Ligue 1's best representatives on the continental stage. And fingers crossed, you know, that they can continue the kind of form that they're in at the moment and, you know, at least get themselves sort of into the top three. But it's going to be very difficult for them to reel in a team like Brest, who, you know, they seem to get the points on the board, regardless of how well they play or not. And when Monaco seem to not play well, that's when they drop points and sort of fall out of the reckoning.
They're currently sitting in third place at the moment. They're 4 points behind Brest. It will be something like the end of an era if Rybolovlev sells the club. I mean, this is the club that Claudio Ranieri brought back up from Ligue 2 when they were almost about to be relegated into amateur football. They were in a disastrous situation, and it was Ranieri that brought them up. And then they, of course, bought James and Falcao, and they had all these players arriving and, you know, players that went on to become and still are starring in some of the biggest clubs in the world. So it will be an interesting one to see. I mean, the project has obviously changed a lot, but Jardim that took them to the title was a remarkable story that this Monaco side, I guess that was probably the high point. And since then, when they sold off all that squad, it got a little more difficult, but they are there or thereabouts. I mean, this is the permanent thing for football clubs in the modern game is to keep evolving and regenerating and transforming yourself. So I guess there's no reason if a new owner does eventually come in. It's not an easy thing though to sell Monaco Football Club, because you have to go through the royal family and convince them that you're the right people to take it over as well. Less complicated, Baptiste, perhaps, to buy and sell, because we've seen that also, and also win a league in recent seasons, are Lille, who are in fourth place on 41 points. Pretty demoralizing loss to Toulouse 2 weeks ago, but they bounced back. 1-0 win over Reims. Jonathan David with the goal, but I mean, that was courtesy just from a disastrous mistake from Abdelhamid, which was a terrible back pass intercepted by Jonathan David. Lille have been on the charge, just faltering a little bit though. I mean, they're going win-loss at the moment. They're playing some good football. Can they keep it up now? Because we're really into the business end of the season.
I think they've got to be encouraged by the fact that Jonathan David is hitting form again. He had a bit of a struggle at the start of the season. He seems to be back in it, and signing Haraldsson is also sort of stepping into the team and delivering. I think they are still a young, inexperienced team in some key areas. So, you know, the likes of Haraldsson, Zegrova, you know, they're very talented players, but they still suffer from a bit of inconsistency. And defensively, you'd say the same thing. They lost Thiago Jallo. They've obviously banked on Leny Yoro, who's extremely impressive, but is still only 18, 19. So I think they're a very well-coached side. There's no doubt that Paulo Fonseca has done a lot with what he's got at his disposal, and he's transformed certain players like Angel Gomez, who's a revelation in midfield as a really small, dynamic number eight. And when you look at the inconsistency of sides around them, I don't see why they can't challenge for a top four. They've got the attacking talent. They've got a good base in midfield. They've got players who have been there, despite the inexperience I've mentioned. The Benjamin Andres are still at the club. And I think they should be really optimistic about it going forward. They have a defined style of play. They know how they're meant to play. Sometimes that can look poor. And we remember last season when they got destroyed a couple of times. We remember the PSG game. And so they're not too far from a hiding sometimes. But I think, broadly speaking, they have a lot to be encouraged about. And they're certainly one of the best coach sides in the country.
JJ, they also have Sturm Graz coming up in the Conference League. And now, not to be disparaging or overconfident, certainly not given the history of French clubs in Europe and in recent years, but Les Dogues, when they start a season in the Conference League, must be looking at going all the way to what, at least to, you know, semi-finals. A French club, a top five leagues club, when you're in the Conference League, you have to be thinking, we are a chance to win this, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think if we're looking at the situation completely objectively with French clubs in Europe, you would expect PSG to reach the quarterfinals of the Champions League. You would expect Marseille to give it a good go and probably edge Villarreal for a place in the quarterfinals of the Europa League. And you'd expect Lille to get past Sturm Graz and be in the quarterfinals of the Europa Conference League. And I think the thing that's specifically interesting about Lille's situation is you look up the rest of the teams in that competition. And with Villa going up against Ajax in one of the other games in the round of 16, that potentially takes out one big and challenging name from the mix. And especially if that was to be Ajax who fall, as much as I'd love it as a Villa fan, you know, that would do wonders as well for the Ligue 1 situation in terms of the coefficient, which obviously took a little bit of a hit with the Europa League playoff situation. But absolutely, you know, I think Lille, with the quality that they have, the players, you know, that Fonseca has at his disposal, you know, they should be targeting this as potentially something that they could, you know, yes, at least reach the semi-final, if not better. You know, I think it's difficult for Fonseca to look at opportunities domestically and target a Ligue 1 title push at this moment in time, or potentially a Coupe de France win. So coming up against, you know, a team like Sturm Graz with an opportunity to get into the Europa Conference League quarterfinals, that is a huge opportunity to take. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they do manage to get there, if they maybe put a bit more emphasis on Europe after that. But obviously there's two very tricky legs that they've got to play out first there. But it would be a fantastic scenario for Ligue 1 if they were to have three quarterfinalists across all the competitions.
Gentlemen, let's have a look at the situation of OGC Nice, which is, I mean, we know that Ineos have spent big on purchasing another club. Is that going to take some of the focus away? Because, look, we had there were big hopes around Nice when Ineos came in. This was a big cycling. Well, first of all, Radcliffe, big money, but one that had had success in cycling, that was into yachting, you know, competitive yachting as well, had a Swiss club already, and this is where it starts to a little crack appears because Lausanne didn't have much success. They were relegated within a season and a half of Ineos taking over. Nice are still not, despite a great start to this season, performing the way many thought they would be. And now, perhaps, obviously, Manchester United becomes the flagship of this Ineos sporting empire. What's going on there at the moment? Because, well, we had Andy Scott on 2 weeks ago, and he was quite damning of the Nice situation, which was a side that was sitting second in the league, having scored less than a goal a game, and that, you know, they were a team that, yes, they can defend well, but they're not exactly a side that are setting the world alight. Baptiste, what do you see is happening now? Because I think that's five without victory now for Nice. And, you know, if it's not for Marcin Bulka stopping all the penalties and making some fantastic saves, it could even be worse. But they lost to Toulouse again now on the weekend.
They've been the victims of their surprising success in the first part of the season, I think. When we looked at the season heading into it, I think most people would have seen Nice as maybe being around sixth or seventh. It's probably a fair reflection, especially with Faioli being an unknown entity. They delivered over the first half of the season, but with a really, really small margin of error. And I think since then, people have had higher expectations, and we're now seeing that margin is so small that when things don't necessarily work out on the day and a defense isn't holding on at all costs, then there's little to look forward to at the other end of the pitch. Despite the talent there, you know, Terem Moffi is a really good Ligue 1 striker, and he does have some support. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we're seeing at the moment is that margin of error has just sort of flipped the other way, and they're not delivering on that. So it's a bit of a struggle. I think they're still where they should be. Criticism aimed at Farioli is maybe a little bit unfair considering the side he inherited last summer, and he's still bedding in, and he doesn't necessarily have the huge support from Ineos, who have been slightly disinterested for more than a year, I would say, now even before the United mm-hmm. acquisition. So it's not the easiest context in which to have your team playing, especially with the hot-blooded expectations in the south of France and Nice. So it's a blip. The question is that blip going to be longer? And we're not seeing the creativity in that side that is necessary to pull it up from where it is at the moment. So that is a concern. You could see them sliding downwards, but I think they will probably end up where they should have ended up in the first place.
JJ, how are you seeing the situation on the Côte d'Azur at the moment with a Nice side that, you know, they are in real danger now of missing out on the European places again? I mean, they had a colourful European season last year, but failed to back it up. And now it looks like it could be 2 years in a row without European football. And that is a blow for this club.
Absolutely. But also at the same time, as you guys have alluded to, you know, it comes at a moment of great uncertainty because we've seen with Toulouse, you know, what happens when you've got investors who are involved in two different clubs who could potentially both be playing in Europe. It seems inevitable, really, that at some point Nice are probably going to miss out in terms of that consideration, especially when the other club in question is Manchester United. But in terms of the bigger problem for Nice and the challenge at the moment, I mean, I think you summed it up really, really well. You know, they're not even scoring a goal a game at the moment. You look at the last four matches, lost three of them, you know, but they haven't even managed to score one goal on average in each of those four games. So it's going to be extremely difficult. And it perhaps not really looking to criticize Farioli too much, because I think he's done an impressive amount in a very short space of time in his career. But I think it points at areas for him to work on in terms of sort of his greater coaching philosophy and the way that he manages the talent that he has. Because as Baptiste said, it wasn't necessarily the best squad that he inherited, but in terms of the talent in attack that he inherited, is actually very well set up to be more prolific than they have been so far this season. And I think that might be the key in terms of them, you know, making it into the European spots or not, because if they continue at this rate, they probably will drop out, you know, sort of in the final month or so of the season.
Baptiste, Olympique Lyonnais were on the charge, 4 wins on the trot, but then they came up against a Lens side who were looking to bounce back from a couple of disappointments that they'd experienced in the last couple of weeks. It was the final match of the round last night, and it was a thumping 3-0 victory for Lens in Lyon. I mean, how did you see this one? And were you expecting such a performance from Lens, who, again, were another side that were struggling to put together consistent results? I mean, it was heartbreaking, their European exit for them when they thought they were almost across the line. They showed a little bit of character here to be able to bounce back.
It was a real demonstration, I thought, from Lens watching the game. They weathered the storm in the first half an hour, and actually Lyon were really impressive in that first half an hour. Orban as a pivot man up top was playing really well, and Kakré in support was really, really dynamic. The Kakré that we liked when he burst through the ranks a couple of years ago. But it was just a sign of a really mature side who just played their way into the game, weathered the storm, found the gaps as Lyon were playing really compact, widened the pitch, and just added a little bit of quality and patience. And I think that was the difference between the two sides, really, is one, which is in Lyon trying to find those automatisms, trying to find those combinations, that way of playing. And they can only keep it up for brief periods of time, maybe 20 minutes in a game, half an hour. Whilst for Lens, it just clicks. People know where they're meant to be, know who they're meant to be combining with. Frankowski was excellent. He's playing left wing back. He can play right wing back. It doesn't matter. Florian Sotoka continues to be a revelation, and some of his passing yesterday was outstanding. And with Eliwahi looking like he's in a bit more in form, even though he suffered an injury yesterday, then they look more and more complete. So, you know, when you add on top of that the fact that they have one of the best managers in the league, in Francais, whose message is widely received by everyone at the club, then it's a potent combination. And it was just a step too high, I think, for Lyon that's still trying to grow a little bit after the horrible first half of the season. And you can see elements of progress, but yesterday they were a little bit too meek in their tactical disposition, in my mind, in the way they pressed, and they found it tough against one of the most complete sides in the country.
JJ, let's finish this review with a look at another side that are starting to find a little bit of form, but perhaps their ceiling is not too far away either. It's Toulouse, who have enjoyed a pretty spectacular season so far in Europe. They only just bowed out against a Benfica side courtesy of a Angel Di Maria double from the penalty spot. I mean, perhaps with a little bit more belief or perhaps a little slice of good fortune, that could have been a little bit different. But again, 3-1 win over Lille, and then another win, 2-1 over Nice. Thijs de Linga on the score sheet again. He's got 9. That will be good for our Deja Vu winner that we're going to announce the Thijs de Linga jersey in a moment as well. But, you know, 3 wins in a row, 5 in their last 7. Toulouse starting to find some form, and, you know, not saying they're going to be contesting for European places, but they're in safety, and you can see that with their young coach, they're trying to build something here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was Sierra who came out recently and said, we're starting to show our true face now. And I think that's there's a big element of truth in that. I saw them up close in the Trophée des Champions against PSG at the beginning of the year, and I thought that they were better value for a decent result there than perhaps the final score suggested. I thought they were a team that looked interesting, that had some good ideas. Obviously, another victim of Rouen on penalties in the Coupe de France. But, you know, they they were really, really unlucky, I felt, in the Europa League in that second leg. You know, I thought they had a dominant performance at home to Benfica, and all that was really missing was the goal to potentially help them to make it through. But, you know, now that they've fallen short, I think they can focus on their main objective. And maybe that was where why this season has been perhaps a little bit deceptive, sort of in terms of their position relative to what we've actually been able to see from them sort of in certain matches, because they've played much, much better than a team that was battling against relegation up until recently. You know, and I think that them rediscovering this kind of form is just sort of the logical result of them dropping out of European and domestic cup contention. They can now focus on the league. Like you said, it's, you know, it's still a very young project, not just in terms of the players, but in terms of the coaching staff as well, and the ideas that they're trying to put together. It's a club that's been rejuvenated in the last couple of years, coming back from Ligue 2, qualifying for Europe, and obviously domestic cup success coming with that as well. So it's, you know, I think it is going to be an interesting last couple of months of the season for them. I expect them to continue sort of on this upward trajectory and potentially sort of finish in the kind of mid-table places. But I'm not really surprised that it started to click now that they've had fewer distractions. They were spread perhaps a little too thinly, I think.
Well, Toulouse currently sit 10th on 29 points. There are 10 matches left this season. They're a point ahead of Olympique Lyonnais. Strasbourg are 3 points behind Toulouse, 2 points behind Lyon in 12th. Then come Lorient and Nantes on 25, Le Havre on 24, Montpellier, who are only just sitting outside the relegation zone, on 23, and then Metz and Clermont are down in the relegation zone in 17th and 18th positions. But it is tight. Reims in 9th place have 34 points. Toulouse on 29 are just 9 points above second from bottom Metz. So I have the sneaking suspicion that a lot more is going to be played out in these last 10 games of the season. So next up, the world of French football has been awash with rumour and speculation since Kylian Mbappe's bombshell announcement that he would indeed be leaving Paris Saint-Germain at the end of this, his 7th season in the French capital. The boy from Bondy, who has scaled the heights of world football while plying his trade in Ligue 1, is moving on. So to help us break down this transfer, while also looking ahead to see what the implications of this massive move mean for both PSG and Ligue 1, we're joined by transfer aficionado and sports broadcaster, Ben Jacobs. Ben, thank you very much for your time.
Robbie, great to be here.
So, Ben, this Kylian move, I mean, it's not official yet, but almost certainly Real Madrid will be the final destination. Is there any chance that another team could come in and scupper this, given that apparently Kylian told the French president just at dinner the other night that the deal wasn't signed on the dotted line just yet?
It's funny, isn't it, that the Kylian Mbappe saga extends to the French president, and it's always been a little bit political. I think that's the games of any big transfer, really. But Kylian Mbappe is going to end up at Real Madrid. I think we can say that with near certainty. There's not going to be a hijack from a Premier League club, that's for sure. We've heard a lot of rumours about Liverpool and Arsenal. But the fact of the matter is that you're not just signing Kylian Mbappe, whether for a fee or on a free transfer. You've got to be able to pay the sign-on fee and the wages as well. And Premier League clubs have got big budgets, but profit and sustainability rules have altered a lot. And as a result, they were never seriously in the conversation. I think if Kylian Mbappe is looking for another club, every single top club in the world has to look to some extent, but that doesn't mean that they've advanced anything. And the feeling has always been that Real Madrid would be the destination if Mbappe chose not to extend at PSG. So what we can say with certainty is that he's told Nasser Al-Khelaifi that he's leaving PSG, so his chapter in France has ended. But as far as the next destination is concerned, there's a couple of things to iron out before Mbappe will sign. One is the nature of the exit, because there's lots of different ways still that he can leave PSG, and they have protected themselves financially under all eventualities. The other thing is the Olympics, which is a big thing. And Kylian Mbappe, if he was to leave PSG, which we now know to be the case, has always seen the final season as a kind of exit that starts with PSG and the hope of winning Champions League and, of course, Ligue 1 and any other domestic silverware, and then ends with the Paris Olympics. And whereas PSG were happy to say, if you extend, we'll let you play in the Euros and the Olympics, there's still conversations ongoing with Real Madrid about how that works, because maybe he enters into free agency, then signs, or maybe there's a later start date. Because if Mbappe was to sign right at the beginning of the off-season, then he's not going to be back at Real Madrid until mid-August. So you miss 3 months. That's 3 months of huge wages. And Real Madrid may want to negotiate that. And Kylian Mbappe also may say, you've still got to pay me from day one, but I won't be joining up with you for pre-season. So there's a lot of little things to iron out. But the reality is that Kylian Mbappe will eventually end up at Real Madrid.
It would be an astounding turn of events if he was clubless when he went to the Olympics, and touch wood, obviously, because you don't want to imagine these kind of eventualities. But a potential injury at an Olympic Games for a professional athlete could be absolutely disastrous. I imagine that's something that has to be ironed out, obviously, when you say that the little dots and I's and T's that need to be crossed. We know that Kylian is a massive fan of Real Madrid. He grew up with photos of Cristiano on his wall. He went and visited them when he was 12 years old, 13 years old, had his photo taken with Zizou. It's a club that has always meant a lot to him. So that Real Madrid had that slight advantage, I guess. But what do we know, the sort of financial implications and magnitude of this deal to get him across? And was that a priority, or was Kylian, had his heart set on joining Real more than anything?
It's a bit of both. I think if there wasn't a financial consideration, it would have been done already. And we know that PSG's offer is, and it is still technically on the table, significantly higher than the one that Real Madrid are currently discussing. In fact, the overall Real package is lower than their offer in 2022, when they thought that Mbappe would end up signing, but instead he extended at PSG. So this isn't about money for Mbappe in the sense of perhaps base wage. The signing on fee might be as big as 150 million euros. And then in addition to that, you have to make an argument that the brand of Mbappe is only going to continue to grow, and he'll be able to cash in by being at Real Madrid. But we certainly shouldn't be disrespectful to PSG. He could cash in whilst he was at PSG too, one of the most fashionable clubs in the world. So Kylian Mbappe can kind of have his cake and eat it financially, because the base wage is going to be probably the biggest, or certainly level with the likes of Jude Bellingham. But then because he's Mbappe and he's his own brand, he's going to be able to earn a lot more through things like image rights and anything on the side that he can do whilst playing with an affiliation to either PSG at the moment or Real Madrid. And then when you add the signing on fee, it's obviously a lot of money. But I think that Mbappe's looked long and hard at the PSG project, and he was clearly enthused enough by it to extend. And it was a difficult decision because PSG are revamping. I'm sure we'll talk about this, but they're buying young, they're buying French where possible, and they're building a new set of routes away from this kind of Galacticos era. And Mbappe, I don't think, is just looking at that and saying, it's too young, it's too new, it's too revamped, I want to walk into a side with a Vinny Jr., with a Jude Bellingham, and just win things instantly. It was probably quite a difficult decision. But the fact that his whole life, he sat on a bed as a kid and looked up at posters of Cristiano Ronaldo, he's walked into the Santiago Bernabeu and been awestruck by it, I think he just feels that his time in Paris is up. And if he doesn't go to Real now, at this point, when they themselves have revamped, then the stars may not align further down the line. He's got plenty of time left in his career. But sometimes you just sense that a new era, maybe another club, is coming. And when you look at the bones of Real Madrid at the moment, the form of Bellingham and Vinny Jr. and many other players, and you add Mbappe, there's a real sense that they're going to dominate. They're going to be unstoppable. And I just think that he wants to be in now, because if he knows if he goes now instead of a few years' time, that might be the difference between several trophies, either won or not won.
Well, certainly it's a mouthwatering prospect for Real Madrid. We will discuss the new transfer policies of Paris Saint-Germain, if you like, in the wake of this, because they've lost some massive names over the last two seasons as well. But let's look about who could come in and potentially replace Kylian Mbappe, because while there is a new transfer policy, you talk about Real Madrid can't afford to not be fighting for the top prizes and winning trophies and revamping. Paris Saint-Germain can revamp the club if they like, but they have to keep winning. And to do that, you need a proven goal scorer. They've brought in a couple this season who haven't perhaps rivaled Kylian in the goal scoring. There's Colomwani, who cost a lot of money from German football, having already left France before that. Gonzalo Ramos as well is another one who's been amongst the goals, but not to the extent that you're just going to forget about Kylian. The club are almost certainly going to try and replace him with a big name. Who do you think that could be?
I think the club will replace Mbappe in a variety of ways. There may not be a like-for-like replacement, but they will sign a flagship striker, if you like, regardless of the names that you've mentioned, a midfielder and a centre-back. And you can do that when Mbappe leaves because you're saving around 200 million gross in terms of the package he was on, and because Mbappe's foregoing bonuses, if the eventuality is that he leaves on a free transfer, that's another 70 to 80 million euros. So suddenly you've got about 280 million euros on your books, at least, that you can invest into the squad. And I think that would be good enough for three players. I think the top target, they're not the same kind of player, but the top forward, if you like, is Victor Osimhen, which I personally think will be difficult because the player's maybe got his heart set on moving to the Premier League. And we know that Chelsea, Arsenal, and some even say Manchester United might be interested. But the advantage that PSG have got is that they can match the 250,000 plus a week wage that Osimhen would like. Then in addition to that, a very interesting one to watch is Marcus Rashford. And PSG have chased Rashford for a while, and he's the kind of profile that they love. And Nasser Al-Khelaifi in particular has said on record that he's a big fan. But it all depends on Rashford. If he wants to be part of this new Ineos-led project, then PSG are not going to court him. But if the player can't directly indicate that there's an opportunity, then PSG would gladly enter that race. And this is because the backstory around Rashford is PSG kind of felt a bit messed around in the past over talks when Rashford hadn't extended at Manchester United, and they felt that they were being used as leverage to get him a better deal at Old Trafford. So now it's a case of we like the player, but we don't want games. And if he indicates that he wants to leave, which is not believed to be the case at the moment, then PSG will come in and enter that race. And the other name to watch is Benjamin Sesko, which again fits the kind of profile that PSG are looking for. Midfield-wise, Gavi is a very ambitious target, but they're obviously not going to trigger his 1 billion euros release clause from Barcelona. Bruno Guimaraes might be an opportunity. Yeah, not yet. But I think that this shows the ambition, but we have to kind of temper that with a little bit of reality, whereas Bruno Guimaraes at Newcastle might be somebody that's a little bit more realistic. And then defender-wise, we know that Leny Yoro is a name that PSG have tried for in the past, and we expect them to make another move this summer. And that, again, falls into this category of what are PSG looking for? Buy young, and where possible, buy French. Leny Yoro, 18 years of age, centre-back, in France at the moment, so utilising the domestic market, France under 21 internationals. So this, again, matches the PSG new profile, where they want to get their average age down. They want to invest in the local market where possible, and they want to buy a little bit younger and keep the players for a little bit longer in the hope, I suppose, that they grow into their price tags and therefore the transfer fees become an investment rather than an expense.
Talking of that then, this new philosophy, because we've seen the likes of Sergio Ramos to be the lesser of the three big exiters last season, I guess, along with Neymar and Messi. This new philosophy, has it been successful so far? Because they've tried to do it with the coach. They brought in Christophe Galtier, who wasn't this big high-profile coach that they've tried with Thomas Tuchel, with Unai Emery beforehand. They've gone back on that after, you know, a largely failed, I guess, project with Galtier that only lasted the one season. In comes Luis Enrique. We know that Luis Enrique has his own model of playing, which is above perhaps all the individual stars and individual qualities. It's very much a team approach. Are they looking, do you think, to recreate themselves a little bit and their image overseas and internationally?
Yes, I think it's taken a bit of time, and that comes with managerial transition. So we can kind of judge the project in two ways. One is these young players that need time, and then the overall strategy of the club, which is also changing. And part of that is also down to the Arctos investment because they're going to be very hands-on in certain projects. And naturally, when you look in these areas, you have to be a bit more patient because young players, even someone, for example, like Ugarte, who's a few years older than these teenagers that we've mentioned, or Warren Zaire, Emery, who is much younger, those types of players are going to need time to develop. But the important thing is almost that you've got them and they start to get minutes. There are counterpoints like Hugo Ekitike not working out at PSG, but maybe there was a bit of a mismatch in culture between player and club. And I think in the end, PSG were quite happy to find a solution there. Not every young player is going to necessarily work out, but the important thing is that they get minutes, they start to develop. And if they have high ceilings, then in 2-3 seasons' time, we'll start to see the project. So then maybe what's important is finding a manager that first of all can develop them and be very hands-on, but second of all is going to stay, because if the manager keeps changing, I think we've seen this at Chelsea as well, who have got a young project, then the young players are not going to get any guidance. So I think the jury's out a little bit, not because PSG haven't signed the right kind of profiles or names, but simply because it will take time when you go from Galacticos to something more youth-led. You're not necessarily going to get an overnight success. So if PSG walk away this season and go far in the Champions League, then they'll be ahead of schedule. If they win domestic honours, then I think they'll be relatively satisfied with that. But it has been a little bit inconsistent, and they've scored enough goals when you just look at the tally. But in certain games, goals have been hard to come by. You think about Monaco on Friday and that 0-0. It's a very good example. So that's going to take time. I think that where PSG have done very well is in protecting themselves as a sustainable long-term brand. And this whole fight over either redevelopment of the Parc des Princes and thus owning it, or finding a new stadium location, is a good example of PSG's strategy off the field and how they're trying to make themselves future-proof, and they're trying to set something up for the long term. They're trying to expand, develop, modernize on and off the field. And again, that's a very lofty ambition and it takes time. So I think certain areas of PSG's strategy are unfair to judge right now. But because the fan base is so used to stars and success, everyone almost has to rejig their thinking and be a bit more patient with a football club that for the last few years, domestically at least, we've associated with instant success.
Well, there are 17 other clubs in the French top flight. Let's chat a little bit about them briefly as well. We know that every year the rising stars from French football are a sure bet to head off, whether it's to Spain, England, Germany, to other leagues. There's something about the French youth production that seems to create these players that are able to land on their feet almost immediately and start playing at an excellent level. It's been the case since the Arsenal revolution, if you like, at the turn of the century. But that's what we've come to expect from French football. There will no doubt be another raft of players leaving during this off-season to different clubs overseas. But can we expect any big names to come to France next season? And certainly, what are the rumours around at the moment for who needs to strengthen themselves?
Yeah, I think what you say is correct, but we have to be very clear that it's a compliment to Ligue 1 in many ways when
absolutely.
So many stars come through. And of course, there's clubs that can offer bigger wages and opportunities, but one or two also end up coming back as well. And that is equally a compliment to Ligue 1. So the first name I want to put out there who's a little bit older, which is very interesting, is actually Habib Diallo. And he left Strasbourg for Al Shabab. And it hasn't really worked out at the moment in terms of goal-scoring output. And the feeling with Al-Shabaab is that they actually might try something ambitious for Alvaro Morata. Whether or not they can pull it off remains to be seen. But Diallo is going to be surplus to requirements in likelihood come the summer. He's still at the moment only 28. I think he'll be 29 by the beginning of next season. And we know that he played for a few French clubs before Strasbourg. He had that loan spell at Brest where he did pretty well, and then Metz where he played over 100 times. And what you have in him is a player that in his last season at Strasbourg got 20 plus goals. And therefore, there will be several teams within Ligue 1 that are taking a very close look at him. There won't be a return to Strasbourg because he's sort of too old for that project, unfortunately. But I think there'll be 6 or 7 other clubs, including, I think, potentially Monaco, that are seriously considering whether to bring him back, because he's not 32, 33. He'll only be 29. Mm. And if you can get someone you think can get you 20-odd goals in Ligue 1, then that could be a very realistic possibility. Then speaking of Monaco, we know Thilo Kehrer on loan at the moment. There's an option to buy. There's a very likely scenario that that is triggered or renegotiated with West Ham because it hasn't quite worked out there. And I think that we should also keep a relatively close eye on Premier League to Ligue 1, where there's four or five players that are looking to maybe develop who haven't previously considered a move to France that might now. And this is what I like to call the sort of Harry Kane effect. And I know that was Germany, but once you kind of get one or two English players thinking, hang on a minute, going abroad is quite fun, going abroad is quite good for my development, at that point, you can get a little bit of an influx. So there's a couple of names to keep a close eye on at this stage. One is actually an older player in Ross Barkley, who's at Luton at the moment. If Luton stay up, then naturally he's not going to go anywhere. But if they go down, and because he's already played for Nice, he could be one to watch. Mm-hmm. And the other player that I'm told is being looked at by a couple of French clubs is Wilfried Ndidi, who would potentially be open to a move as well. Lens and Lyon are two clubs that have tracked him. And depending on Leicester's situation over the course of the next few weeks, and if they get promoted back to the Premier League, that one might grow legs as well.
Fantastic. Ben Jacobs, thank you very much for your time. It's been very insightful and an absolute pleasure. We hope to speak to you again soon.
Thanks for having me on, and keep up the good work.
Let's have a quick look or a quick review of the Coupe de France and maybe just a little tip looking ahead to the semi-finals and one last quarterfinal that is still to be played in 10 days' time or week, midweek in 2 weeks' time. Olympique Lyonnais overcame Strasbourg. It took penalties. They did it 4-3. They will now take on Valenciennes in the semi-finals. Ligue 2 Valenciennes overcame third division Rouen on penalties as well. So that's the penalty shootout semi-final. And Le Puy Foot bowed out at the hands of Stade Rennais as well. It was 3-1. Benjamin Brugeot continuing his good goal-scoring form after his hat-trick against AC Milan. He got a double as they are knocked out the Petit Poussé, or Little Tom Thumb, as he's known in French football and the Coupe de France. They will still get to be at the final, Le Puy, as the Petit Poussé, and do their tour of the stadium as the amateurs that made it further than any other amateurs in the competition. Gentlemen, start with you, Baptiste. Rennes will play the winner of Paris Saint-Germain and Nice, the final quarterfinal, which is to be played on the 13th of March. What do you think is going to happen there in PSG Nice? Let's not forget that it was Galtier's Nice that knocked PSG out a couple of years ago.
I would expect a PSG win, considering the run of form that Nice is on, that we've just discussed. And even though PSG have just gone through two draws in the league, I think there's just too much talent there and too much desire at this time of the season. But I actually think for the semi-final, Rennes have tended to be PSG's bogey team over the last 2 to 3 seasons. It's always been a tough game for PSG, as we've seen very recently, just 2 weeks ago. So I think there's a good chance of upsets actually in the semi-finals of the cup, because I don't think this is the most serene Lyon side either going into bat against Valenciennes, who'd be buoyed by being in that position in the first place. So there's a real chance of upset in each semi-final for me.
JJ, Nice are the only side that have beaten Paris Saint-Germain this season in the league. In the Champions League, it's a different story. Can they do it again in the cup?
I mean, I think we're getting to a point now where they're going to feel like they really need to if their league form continues to slide. But equally at the same time, you know, like Baptiste said, I agree. I think PSG will probably have too much for them because at the end of the day, let's not forget that although PSG have won the Coupe de France many times, they're now on a bit of a drought in terms of what's happened in recent years. And I think they'll really want to avoid being knocked out sort of almost in consecutive seasons by Nice. So this one is, that's one I think that will probably go to form. PSG will end up going through, but I agree. I think Rennes in the semi-finals, that one really, has a potentially tricky element to it, because Rennes as well, although they've come back into form massively under Julien Stéphan, and I know that he was very much aggrieved with PSG's late penalty a couple of weeks ago at Parc des Princes, where he said it was the penalty that the big teams get right at the very end of the game via VAR. Mm-hmm. In like the seventh minute of added time or something. And obviously, Stéphan was the coach of the Rennes team, I think, who led Rennes to success against PSG in the Coupe de France final a few years back as well. So I think that one could be the trickier one for PSG. I do think that they will make it past Nice and then have a bit of a harder time against Rennes. But I'm really curious to see what happens with Valenciennes, because it looks like they're dead and buried in Ligue 2. They'll be going to the third tier Championnat National next season, unless there is a miraculous turnaround in form. But you look at the way that they weathered the pressure of the penalty shootout against Rouen. You do feel like if Lyon don't sort of get on the front foot immediately in that game, there could be some doubts in their mind, because this, for Lyon, PSG still in the Coupe de France or not, this is a huge opportunity for them to get themselves into European contention.
I love the talk of the Gonzalo Ramos penalty in Paris, just because we all know that any penalty given in the last minute for the big team playing at home is going to be, the home team's penalty. What I always love, which I thought spoke wonders of Paris and the people of Paris, was when I first arrived in France and would go to the Parc des Princes as a fan. And when there was a decision that clearly went Paris's way, or you had an opposition player complaining and surrounding the referee, the entire stadium chants, "Ici c'est Paris," which is, "This is Paris." And there is such a self-aware, tongue-in-cheek knowledge that, what do you expect? This is Paris. You're in Paris now. This is how it is. You cannot win. And we're proud of that. We as a people are proud of the fact that this is in Paris, and this is what happens when you come and play us here. So it was nice and quite Parisian, I think, in many respects as well.
Everybody hates Paris, and no one knows that better than the Parisians themselves. And it's a source of pride in a way, so it doesn't surprise me.
All right, Paris Saint-Germain also have some continental business to finish the second leg of their last 16 tie with Real Sociedad. JJ, you told us that you are going to be there for this big one. Paris Saint-Germain are leading 2-0 from the first leg. It was Kylian Mbappe and Barcola with the goals in that one to secure that victory. As you said earlier, it was a very tough match. Luis Enrique said the first 45 minutes were particularly challenging for his side. Some might say they were a little bit lucky or fortunate to emerge with a two-goal buffer to take to Spain. My question is that you piqued my interest when you were chatting about Paris Saint-Germain and the Kylian Mbappe situation at the moment. Is, yes, Luis Enrique has to prepare for next season, but Luis Enrique also has to try and win the Champions League. And when you have a player, arguably the best player in the world, on your books, fit and healthy, who knows that this is his last season and wants to, yes, you have to prepare for the future, but you also have to win in the here and now. Surely you have to play Kylian Mbappe in the Champions League, and you can experiment in, a cup semi-final perhaps, or a Ligue 1 match against a mid-table opponent. But these are matches you have to win. Surely you have to have your strongest 11 out on the pitch.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think it should really be a topic of discussion. Kylian Mbappe should be playing and starting in any Champions League games from here on out. But I think Coupe de France at this stage of the competition is a bit different. I would experiment more in Ligue 1. And to be honest, I'd push that up to even some of the higher ranked teams. I think that at the end of the day, the likes of Colomouani, the likes of Ramos are going to need to get used to playing in a PSG team that is favourites to win the titles against some of the best teams in Ligue 1. But in the Champions League, you need your best players when they're available. And you almost need to wrap Kylian Mbappe in cotton wool, because let's not forget, there's been a couple of injury scares in recent weeks. I know it didn't factor into Luis Enrique's decision to withdraw him in Monaco, but he did pick up a knock in that game, took a very heavy knock against Brest and was very, very lucky to not come away from that one seriously hurt. So, you know, I do think, despite him speaking publicly about how he loves, you know, that there's basically a game every 3 days and playing as often as possible, that you really need to be careful and manage Kylian Mbappe's condition as well. It's certainly as long as PSG are still fighting on all fronts for silverware. So for me, I think it's a no-brainer. He has to start this one. And also a shout out to Hamari Traore as well for his role in PSG getting that upper hand in the first leg as well. I felt very sorry for him listening to Imanol Aguathil's comments after the game, where he basically put a lot of the blame on Traore for going off the pitch at that crucial moment for treatment on an injury when PSG finally took the lead. I thought that was a little harsh. I thought he'd had a very good game and that Sociedad were very impressive up to that point. There was that Marino shot that smacked the crossbar, which would have been an absolute blinder had it gone in. But I thought PSG were good value for that result overall, with their more clinical edge in the second half and a beautiful goal by Barcola. And I think, you know, if PSG can maintain this unbeaten run that they're on, because we don't really talk about it that much, it dates back to the Milan game away. You know, that's November. I think it's 20 plus games now PSG are unbeaten in. You know, that is the kind of form that's going to do wonders for PSG mentally in this kind of game, because you expect Sociedad to give it everything. But I ultimately think PSG will prevail. And perhaps Mbappe will play a key part in that again.
Baptiste, we know that Paris Saint-Germain, certainly in recent seasons, have struggled at the business end to live up to all the hype and the weight of expectation on their shoulders as well. It was a tough first half. I agree with JJ insofar as I think the quality of Paris Saint-Germain's squad and their play in the second half, it was just a little bit too much for Real Sociedad. They defeated Mallorca straight after that game against Paris Saint-Germain, but have then since lost to Villarreal. Then they lost to Mallorca on penalties in the cup semifinals as well. And then they lost to Sevilla yesterday, this weekend. So that's been a tough run for them. We know they are struggling a little bit in La Liga. What do you think? Can Paris Saint-Germain let this slip? I mean, a two-goal lead surely in the last 16 is enough, but we have said that before and we have seen it before.
Yeah, never say never, obviously, but I think with Luis Enrique, there is a stability and a base there in that side, which makes it a lot more solid and a lot smarter when it comes to European football and big games. We've seen that this season, even in the big games in Ligue 1, that they just don't leave themselves as open as they might have done in the past. And I think their collective is just a bit more well-oiled, frankly. He's got them ticking a bit better and better organized. And then on top of that, if you add the likes of Kylian Mbappe, who's, there's no objective justification for dropping him onto the bench in a game of this magnitude. You're always going to be in the game. And I think it's a tough ask for Sociedad. I thought they were excellent in the first leg. But at the end of the day, over 180 minutes, talent is going to win out unless the team is completely disorganized. And I don't see PSG being as wildly disorganized as they would have been in the past during the previous remontadas. So, I'd be very confident if I were PSG. But obviously, you know, never say never. The likes of Marquinhos, who suffered in the past from his capitulations, he's still there. He's still technically a leader of the club. And so, you know, an early goal by Sociedad could rattle them, and with Oyarzabal being back in the side, they've obviously got a great creative and goal scoring outlet at Sociedad, but it feels like a step too high for Sociedad at the moment.
Check out Ligue1.com for all your top flight news from France, more highlights, match previews, stories, and feature profiles and articles than any rational human being could ever tolerate. It's all right there on Ligue1.com. Parcours Atypique. Now, this is not about hyperactive urban youngsters leaping perilously around brutalist housing projects. Parcours Atypique translates effectively as an atypical career path. It's a term used in French when a player makes it all the way to the top flight without having gone through the more customary youth academy and then senior team pathway. There are some fantastic examples of players that have managed to emerge from a parcours atypique, starting with World Cup winners N'Golo Kanté and Adil Rami. France Marseille and Bayern Munich legend Franck Ribéry was another one who was picked out of Metz, I think, or Brest, was playing for Brest in the second division, then Metz in the second division. Then anyway, Monaco's Wissam Ben Yedder is one that came through futsal. And of course, Marseille and Lyon legend Mathieu Valbuena, who was told he was too small from just about every youth academy he went to. I think he was playing for Libourn when he finally got a break, having done it the hard way. Well, the latest player in this long list is Teddy Turmer. Now, how did Stade de Reims's number 10 go from working as a driver in his dad's company to being Will Still's playmaker with an eye for the spectacular goal and a Malta international? All of that in just 8 years. Well, Angus Terode, our aficionado of the atypical, investigated.
Teddy Turmer may have arrived in Champagne Country the season after Will Still's side stunned everyone with that 19-match unbeaten streak, but the fact that the Champagne club continues to occupy the top half of the Liga Uber Eats table is in no small part down to their swooping Maltese Falcon in midfield. Indeed, the 30-year-old has brought his steely mentality and international experience to bear this season, and coupled with some simply stunning goals, he has done more than his fair share in putting Stade de Reims into the fight for Europe next season. However, it hasn't always been that way. A little over 8 years ago, Turmer was still only playing the game part-time and had scarcely allowed the dream of playing international football to even enter his head. So how did this transformation take place and where did it come from? Even Turmer says he doesn't know the secret. If someone had told me I'd be where I am today, I'd have found it hard to imagine. But in the end, it happened naturally, with hard work and self-confidence. I've always wanted to succeed in football, and that's always been part of my mentality to want more. When I signed my first professional contract, even though it was a childhood dream, I didn't want to stop there. I wanted even more. His journey began at amateur club Hier FC, near his native Toulon, where the young Teddy spent 9 years in youth and senior setups learning the trade. Around the same time that a certain 16-year-old Kylian Mbappe was creating a stir further down the Mediterranean coastline, launching his soon-to-be superstar rise into the Monaco senior squad, Turmer, 4 years older, was struggling with much more pragmatic concerns. Balancing his footballing ambitions and sports science studies was simply earning enough to make a living, saying, "Even though I've always been ambitious, I've always had a good head on my shoulders. I realised I was at an age where it was going to get harder and harder to become a professional player, so I stopped studying. It was out of the question for me to stay at home and do nothing, knowing that football still didn't allow me to make a decent living. So I worked for my father's company for just over a year." Right away, Turmer had his best season with Hier, prompting an offer from third-tier club Boulogne-sur-Mer, which demanded a move north to the other end of the country. "It wasn't exactly what I was expecting, but I took the risk. I went far away from home, far from my family cocoon, to try to succeed in football. Today, I think I can say that it was the right choice." 3 seasons later, whilst Mbappe was lifting the World Cup with Les Bleus in Russia, Turmer was at a new club, Red Star FC, where he might not have been grabbing the headlines of France's new attacking icon, but now also more attack-minded himself, he had done his part in helping his new Parisian club to promotion to Ligue 2. Keen to experience the world of professional football, he turned down an offer in the summer of 2018 to move to Belgian second division club Union Saint-Gilloise. But after a tough first half of the season that saw Red Star change coaches and be embroiled in a fight for survival, Turmer had a change of heart, looking to avoid a winter of discontent. The move worked out. He quickly settled, and over the next 4.5 years, Turmer morphed into even more of a playmaker and leader. As captain, he helped Union win promotion to the Belgian top flight for the first time in close to half a century. His form so good that it earned him a surprise international call-up. Turmer's rise had caught the eagle eyes of the Maltese FA, who had unearthed the Maltese grandfather of a grandfather that revealed Turmer to actually be of Maltese extraction. "I was interested in becoming an international player, and I wasn't going to invent a life for myself. I knew I was never going to be called up to the French national team, so why not Malta? Everyone thinks I play there to treat myself to a nice holiday, but it has made me progress like crazy. I've played against England, Italy, and even Luka Modric's Croatia. This big increase in responsibility for club and country taught Toma to temper his crazy side. But it also made him realise that this drive for success is something he has the knack for bringing out of others, especially via his viral pre-match team talks. I want to win every game, whether it's a friendly, in the league or the cup. That's what I want to pass on to every club I play for. In my head, if I don't succeed, that's not okay. And I'm not going to leave the pitch before I've succeeded. That's just the way I am. Season 22-23 was a huge one for Union and also for Toma. Reaping a personal best, 16 goals and 18 assists as he captained his side into the Europa League quarterfinals and a third-place finish in the league. All of which caught the eye of a certain Anglo-Belgian coach working in France. Will still usually tells his team why he's recruited a player. There was a video where, to put it politely, you could see my vicious side, surly side, with me getting fired up and going to have a word with the referee. Will wants me to bring that energy to this team, which is very young and needs to learn. So Will also took me on because he needed a bit of a ball breaker on the pitch. Ball breaker, yes, at times sure, but Teddy Toma is so much more than that. A versatile midfielder, a leader by example both on and off the pitch, and a scorer of stunning goals. That's the beauty of the parkour atypique. When a player charts his own course through the world of football, it necessarily forges in them a strong character. Which is to say that Teddy Toma is a superb player he is today, not despite his parkour atypique, but rather because of it. And he is every bit as much at home on a Liga Uberitz pitch as the likes of Kylian Mbappe. Chapeau, or hats off to Teddy.
Okay, Trivia Nauts, it's time to go Trivia Nuts as the hunt for French football's golden fleece returns. That's right, it's Deja Vu, the epic French football quiz that has you fighting flame-spitting bulls and planting dragon's teeth. Well, perhaps we're going a bit too far. The point is, you listen to my potentially deranging clue and then tell me which past or present Ligue 1 Uber Eats star I am talking about. If you manage to get it right, you can go into the running to win a Ligue 1 Uber Eats jersey. And, as we've already mentioned, we have the winner for February's signed Thijs de Linge Toulouse jersey to announce today. Anyone who answered former Bordeaux and Netherlands man Richard Witschke for the first clue, and his fellow Batave Justin Cliver, or Justin Clivert, as he's probably known. Dad Patrick, obviously, former Dutch legend and Barcelona and Lille player as well. He was our second name. So if you got either of Richard Witschke or Justin Clivert, you went into the draw. We had plenty of correct answers, but there can only be one winner, and that is Nicolas Le Mercier, who got both correct answers with some astute meta-analysis involving the irony of having a Bordeaux player as an answer to win a Toulouse jersey. So the TFC fan, Nicolas, will now have his very own Thijs de Linge jersey to wear to his next Toulouse home match. So congratulations to Nicolas. And now, for next month or this month's jersey chance, we are giving away a Teddy Toma Stade de Reims jersey. And if you want to go into the running to win it, you have to get the Who Am I question either this time or in 2 weeks' time when we will then be preparing the winner. So here is the clue. Who am I? Born in the years immediately following World War II, I came through the youth ranks of the side I supported as a kid, making my senior debut as an 18-year-old. In 5 years, I twice finished top scorer in my homeland before heading to France. Once in Ligue 1, I wore the colours of three sides, and while I never won a trophy during the seven seasons, I did finish top scorer five times and finished with a ratio of nearly a goal a game. I then returned to my first club, continuing to find the back of the net to the point of becoming my club's all-time leading goal scorer, before coming back to France one final time as a player, and during which season I was actually player coach before beginning my second footballing career as an enormously successful coach, particularly back in my homeland, where I was so successful that two clubs erected statues in my honour. Who am I, and who was I playing for when I scored 6 goals in a single match of top flight football, and against who did I score them? So there you go. There are the clues. I've got some knowing looks from our two Ligue 1 experts. If you know, send us an email. Send your answer to league1podcast@gmail.com, and you could go into the running for that splendid Teddy Tuma jersey. One extra little clue I will add, because I've interviewed this man a couple of times, and he has glasses so thick that when he was playing without them in the 70s and 80s, he could barely see who was crossing him the ball. Isn't that incredible? And yet, a remarkable striker in front of goal. So there you go. I've given you some even extra clues there, which should help you find the answer to that one. Thank you for being here yet again. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, whatever your platform is, and tell your friends. All right, gentlemen, it is time now to look ahead to the next 2 weeks of action, rounds 25 and 26. Big games coming up, as always, in the French top flight. We've got 10 matches left. Baptiste, we'll start with you in round 25. Paris Saint-Germain entertain Reims in the early kickoff game on the Sunday. There's always a couple of these that Paris Saint-Germain are always a little bit shaky on, that players don't like getting up so early and having their normal 9 p.m. routine upset. And then we've also got Olympique de Marseille against Nantes. That's one for the nostalgics. Nice take on Montpellier. Strasbourg are at home to Monaco. Lille-Rennes is another big one as well. What takes your fancy here, and what can you see happening in round 25?
I'm very intrigued by the Lens-Brest game, which I think might be the first game. Two sides in form, especially after Lens's impressive win yesterday against Lyon, where they look really composed and really ready to make a run for it. And obviously Brest, we've talked about the surprise package of the season, but find a way to keep grinding out wins when they need to. So I think that would be an interesting one between two of the best managers in the league, in Francaise and Eric Roy, who deserve all the plaudits.
Whoever would have thought we'd hear that phrase? Seriously, I know I can't quite get over it, but the two of the best coaches in the league, Francaise and Eric Roy. Goodness. And it's true. It's true. They have done outstanding work. JJ, round 26, we have Rennes entertaining Olympique de Marseille. Paris Saint-Germain are on the road to Montpellier. Monaco against Lorient. Lens-Nice is another big one, which could just about be not a final nail in the coffin of Nice. And perhaps at the other end of the table as well, Clermont entertain Le Havre. Metz are on the road to Reims, so there are some big matches coming up there. And we talk about nostalgics. Nantes-Strasbourg for the 80s Ligue 1 football fan is a nice one there as well.
Absolutely. I'm going to throw you a curveball, though. I'm actually going to look at that doubleheader for Clermont, because I think if Clermont don't beat Le Havre and then also Metz, two massive games at the bottom of the table, I think they can probably kiss goodbye to their hopes of staying in Ligue 1. I think it's already they're already going to be facing a really tough task. And they've made a very interesting move, which I believe is in the process of being finalized, where they are basically following the Lyon blueprint of getting the assistant manager to Habib Bey at Red Star, Sébastien Bichat, who's going to come in for the remainder of the season and basically be the assistant to Pascal Gestien, who we've known was always going to be in his final season with Clermont. And regardless of what happens, whether they stay in Ligue 1, whether they drop down to Ligue 2, he will be leading the Clermont project from there on in. So I think if Clermont were able to get, say, 4 points out of 6, although they probably really need 6 from 6 at this point, I think that's really their only shot at salvation. Otherwise, I think we can probably wave goodbye to Clermont with fairly strong confidence.
Well, I appreciate the fact that in this, as we enter the business end of the season, that you can both pick out, like, admire the coaching of Eric Roy and then look towards two games of Clermont to be the most exciting thing coming up in the next 2 weeks of Ligue 1 football. That's why we have you here, though.
I said it was intriguing, not exciting.
It is massively important, and it is. And I'm being honest. I am genuinely. This is why we have you guys on, because this is not just your brushing over. We are in the weeds of Ligue 1 football, doing it tough, and it's good. It's excellent. That is the end of this monstrous episode. We've got through a whole heap. It's going to be long. Thank you once again for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for your bi-monthly fix of all things Ligue 1 and their implications for the continent, hell, the entire world, as we've just heard. We'll be all over Ligue 1 because we'll also be looking into the European matters, reviewing Paris Saint-Germain's crunch second leg against Real Sociedad, looking at what's next for the remaining French representatives. Hopefully there are still three involved in the competition. We've got the Coupe de France semi-finals will be coming up. We'll know who is the final piece of that puzzle as well. There'll be a new Deja Vu clue for that Teddy Tuma jersey. Professor Andreas Evagora will be back with our next installment of Ligue 1 Legends. We're going to look at Mr. George, the Paris Saint-Germain, Monaco and Marseille legend. We have everything else that happens and moves in French football. So until then, on behalf of the entire Le Beaujeu team, from Baptiste and JJ and myself, Robbie Thompson, we will see you again very, very soon. Bye, everyone. Go for goal! Terry Buffett! Eli White.